A National City Casualty v. Forge Industrial, Appeal Number 083110. Mr. Baker.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Baker on behalf of the defendant and appellant, Forge Industrial Staffing. Most of the argument is set forth in the briefs. I'll just try to be as brief as I can. Four charges of discrimination were leveled at Forge Industrial Staffing before the EEOC. All essentially were disparate treatment discrimination charges, and Forge asserted its right to independent conflict counsel because what it perceived and continues to assert was a conflict of interest on the part of counsel appointed, represented by the insurance carrier National Casualty Company, or NCC. It's important to look at the NCC policy wording. The policy generally extends coverage for any disparate impact or disparate treatment claim subject to a number of exclusions, the one most pertinent being an exclusion for willful discrimination. And the wording is important, so I'll quote it for the record. The policy excludes coverage for any claim based upon the willful failure by the insurer to comply with any law or governmental or administrative order or regulation relating to employment practices. And then the policy goes on to define the term willful to mean acting with intentional or reckless disregard for such employment-related laws, orders, or regulations. In the present case, counsel appointed on behalf of Forge was laboring under a conflict of interest for this reason. Any discrimination that was proven against Forge Industrial Staffing would, in all likelihood, be for intentional discrimination. Disparate treatment discrimination is, by its very nature, discrimination which is intentional. The only issue remaining would be whether Forge could rebut an inference of willfulness. The Supreme Court in Kolstad recognized a distinction in the law between simple proof of discriminatory intent, which you find in every disparate treatment case, and separate proof of willful disregard for federal law. I won't recite everything in Kolstad because it's in all the briefs. That's what gives rise to the conflict in this case, Your Honors.
Well, none of the underlying plaintiffs claimed that Forge willfully violated anti-discrimination laws. Why doesn't that preclude us from finding that an actual conflict exists in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me address that directly. What the Supreme Court in Kolstad at least implied, and I think it's fairly clear from the decision, is that every time a plaintiff in a disparate treatment discrimination claim proves discrimination or disparate treatment, it carries with it, embedded in it, an inference of willful discrimination. Because what the court is saying in Kolstad is once that inference comes into being, once it's determined, you know, there's prima facie evidence that you discriminated intentionally, that's deemed willful unless you, the defendant, can come forth with affirmative proof casting doubt on whether or not you acted willfully. And then the Supreme Court gives a laundry list of different pieces of evidence that the defendant can come forth to try to exculpate himself from an inference of willfulness.
Well, when the NCC's attorney defends Forge against the plaintiff's intentional discrimination claims, following your logic, doesn't it necessarily then also defend Forge against charges that it willfully violated the law?
No, Your Honor. And here's why. Certainly, if the defense lawyer successfully defends the charge of intentional discrimination successfully, all the cards get swept off the table, the claim is over, and the defendant wins. The problem arises because of the willfulness aspect of it, the ability to rebut willfulness. It's not true that by successfully defending the intentional discrimination charge that you necessarily refute willfulness. If you could, for example, there are cases in which you could defend the entire intentional discrimination claim without ever getting into the separate proof relating to willfulness. For example, and there are numerous examples, but I'll give two. One of them is you can rebut willfulness as a defendant by showing that your company has a valid anti-discrimination policy that comes down from the highest levels of the company. You can assert that and show that a lower-level management acted in violation of that company policy. Then you will have rebutted willfulness. You could still be held liable in the underlying discrimination claim, but it would not be deemed a willful violation.
That model doesn't fit this case, though, does it?
Well, Your Honor, it could very easily fit this case. It could fit any case. The point, however, to keep in mind...
How could it fit this case?
Your Honor, under Illinois law, no attorney is allowed to represent an insured under a policy laboring under a conflict of interest. There's a conflict of interest if there's even a possibility.
No, but Illinois law hasn't gone as far as you want us to go here, has it? There's no Illinois case that incorporates this.
Oh, no, sir, Your Honor. There is no Illinois precedent dealing with the application of Peppers in an EEOC case.
Doesn't that present us with a problem? This is a federal court. Should we extend state law in the way that you are suggesting we do? Is that appropriate? Is that permissible?
Yes, Your Honor. And it is because Illinois has already stated the general principle of law in Peppers. It's the mutually exclusive test, which is very familiar to every Illinois practitioner.
Yeah, well, that's negligence versus intention. That's easier to see than what you're talking about here.
Your Honor, I would submit that in this case it's just as easy to see. What you really have here is not negligence versus intent. You have the exact same mutually exclusive test carried one degree higher on the order of intent. Since every disparate treatment case involves intentional discrimination, the dispute isn't between negligence versus intent, but intent versus willful conduct. And the exact same problem, the exact same conflict arises in this context as arises in the garden variety negligence versus intent context. You have a lawyer who can steer the defense of the case toward non-coverage by simply allowing or failing to rebut evidence of willfulness. And as long as that's the case, that lawyer is under a conflict of interest, whether
it's
just, it goes...
It's really hard for me to understand that, because if a lawyer stands by and lets willfulness come into the record, that hurts him on his intentional discrimination defense.
Your Honor, there are cases in which that certainly would be the case. There are other cases, however, where that's not the case. For example, best example would be you have a discrimination claim that comes in that looks like a loser on liability. That's how it, by the way, comes up in the negligence versus intent context as well. In the negligence versus intent context, the reason that there's concern and why there is a Peppers doctrine is because you got a defense lawyer who realizes, hey, there's a case that just came in here where we got a really bad liability problem, and my carrier is going to have a huge exposure unless there's a finding of intentionality. So that lawyer can steer the case towards proof of intent. The same thing can happen in the context of a Title VII claim. You got a really bad Title VII claim where it looks like, boy, these guys really did discriminate. Now that defense lawyer has to ask himself, all right, I'm going to probably lose this case on liability in terms of intentional discrimination. Is there any way that I can steer this case toward non-coverage? Well, yes, there is. What I got to do is make sure that I show it's willful, or at least not come up with evidence that it wasn't willful. I'm not saying that that's going to happen in every case or that most practitioners are going to stoop to that. But what it demonstrates, Your Honor, is that there's a conflict of interest, and that's what Peppers is based on.
And so the result is in that, in the defense of any EEOC action, the insured is entitled to employ independent counsel?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Only in those cases where the insurance carrier raises the willful defense by way of reservation of rights. That's what happened here. Had it never been raised...
So, in other words, they can't have that exclusion in their policies.
They can have the exclusion in the policies, and they can raise it or not. You could just as easily make the same argument, for example, Your Honor, in a policy covering negligence. You could say, gosh, in any negligence case, you're going to have to provide Peppers counsel where you raise the intentional exclusion, which get raised all the time. The answer is you chose to be in the business of writing that kind of a risk. You don't get to walk away from your responsibilities to your insured just because you have a burden that's placed upon you.
So you're saying that at the point when counsel raises a willful defense, that's when the Pepper's counsel would kick in.
Yes, Your Honor. That's our primary point here, and I just want to make that part as clear as I can because I think that's the main germ of our argument.
Since these are just at the EEOC stage and no allegation of willfulness is there, haven't you just argued yourself out of your case?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, no civil complaints have been filed. They're just claims with the EEOC at this point, and none of them involve allegations of willfulness.
Your Honor, what happens frequently at the EEOC stage, as I'm sure the Court is aware, is that positions can be taken by parties that will indelibly affect the manner in which that case is defended down the line. If evidence comes on that is unhelpful on the question of willfulness, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's wrong to think, I believe, I would submit to the Court, that you should take lightly any EEOC proceeding. And if we weren't talking about insurance coverage, no one would suggest that a party defending himself against an EEOC charge is not entitled to counsel who is fully behind him and not conflicted. And I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Crouch.
May it please the Court, Thomas Crouch on behalf of the Appellee National Casualty Company. Good morning. I think we've seen kind of unfold in the questions exactly the problem with the appellant's case from the outset, and that is we didn't have allegations of the type of claims that, the willful claims that fall within that exclusion.
Well, then, if intentionally discriminating against an employee is the same thing as willfully violating anti-discrimination laws, then what's the purpose of having the willfulness exclusion?
Well, I think it's explained, I think, by the analysis of the Colstead case, drawing the distinctions between the level of proof necessary for a punitive damage type claim and drawing that distinction between intentional discrimination on the one hand, which, of course, is covered by the policy, and the next step up, which would be proof that the conduct was engaged in with knowledge or reckless disregard to whether you were violating the statute.
But that's the question, whether you knew what the law was, isn't that it?
Yes.
Willful if you were aware of the law.
Right. And the trial court really did, or the district court really did three things here, and I think none of them are particularly controversial when it comes to analyzing Pepper's issues. It basically looked at the allegations of the charges, which is exactly what case after case in Illinois has said. You start your Pepper's analysis with comparing the allegations of the claims to the policy's coverage. It found no allegations of willfulness. Secondly, it therefore concluded that this wasn't a case presenting a situation where we would have mutually exclusive covered and non-covered claims, and of course that's precisely what the analysis is, as shown by cases like Nandorf.
So then your view would be that in order for an actual conflict to exist, the underlying plaintiffs would need to specifically state in their complaint that the employer willfully violated the law. That's basically your position, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But
in order to sustain a Title VII discrimination claim, the plaintiffs need not allege that willful violation before the EEOC, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
So there's just an additional burden then on plaintiffs to identify willfulness before the EEOC.
Well, keep in mind also, I think you're honing in on a good point here, and Judge Tinder did too. These are EEOC proceedings. We don't even have a complaint in a litigation format where damages can be sought and awarded. We're at a preliminary stage where, a filtering stage, if you will.
Exactly. But often those cases then do move to the complaint stage.
And so then
if a complaint is filed and willful conduct is alleged, and there's already been some discovery below. I mean, if willfulness is alleged then in the complaint, then they'd be entitled to separate counsel.
If you're asking in every case where there's a willfulness allegation in a complaint in litigation, I'm not sure I'd be willing to concede that in every single case that
that's the lack of willfulness usually injected as a defense rather than as part of the complaint.
In a litigation context, no. Yeah. I suspect that if a plaintiff is going to seek punitive damages, they're going to make that allegation.
I didn't know what the law was.
I'm sorry?
Isn't that a matter of defense, ordinarily, rather than part of the complaint?
No, Your Honor. I believe a plaintiff to plead a claim for punitive damages would make that allegation.
Punitive damages is a special case. That doesn't apply here, I don't think.
Well, keep in mind the only reason a claimant is going to allege that, they don't need to allege that for a Title VII claim to seek compensatory damages. They do need to plead intentional discrimination.
No, but willfulness is a matter of did you know what the law was or didn't you know what the law was?
Right.
So maybe I should
think ordinarily that would be the defendant would say would inject that into the case. I didn't know what the law was.
That would be the type of defense they're claiming where I believed I had an exception, a bona fide occupational qualification. I thought I could do this. That would be a defense both to an intentional claim and a punitive damage claim.
So I should have amended my hypothetical to say you've got a straight Title VII, okay? Then you've got a punitive damages claim as well with willful conduct. So it would kick in if that were raised in the complaint, willfulness. Then a plaintiff would be entitled to get counsel.
That would be the earliest.
Depending on what the defense might be.
Yeah, that would be the earliest. And, of course, you're talking about a claim that happens in court.
Right.
Not at the EEOC stage.
But what counsel's big argument is then is that couldn't at the EEOC level the lawyer manipulate the evidence in some way to the disadvantage of the plaintiff so that it might not be apparent in the EEOC case, but then in the case that's brought, assuming they get past the EEOC hurdle, that the facts could be manipulated in a way such that no coverage would exist.
I don't think that could ever happen at an EEOC stage, and here's why. The key to all of the cases in Illinois that talk about Peppers is a proceeding in which you have the resolution of fact issues that are going to impact the right to coverage. Okay, I mean, that's the fundamental premise. And you don't have any specific resolution of a fact issue in an EEOC stage. You don't have a binding determination by anybody, nor do you have an award of damages of any type at the EEOC stage. So I would disagree with the suggestion that the groundwork can be laid for the disclaimer of coverage.
But there are statements that are submitted, witness statements, those kinds of things that are provided at the EEOC stage.
There's certainly investigation that the EEOC conducts. But there isn't a resolution of any sort of fact. And that's the key part of the entire Peppers line cases. I guess I'm just going to sum up with what I thought were going to be my first three main points, and that was the three things I think the trial court did that are not particularly controversial. It said, look, at the EEOC charges, I'm supposed to look at those and determine whether there are allegations that would invoke an exclusion and create the situation where there's mutually exclusive covered and non-covered, such that a defense attorney could lay the groundwork. And the judge just said there weren't any. And then it went on to the next phase where there were these arguments made about Kolstad and this distinction between punitive damages based on willful conduct. And the court said, look, and the fact that there might be a future punitive damage claim at some point doesn't meet the requirements of Illinois law. You have to have an actual conflict at this point in time. And the fact that there might be a claim made in the future isn't enough to trigger the Peppers counsel. None of those are particularly controversial, and I'd ask that the court affirm.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. How much time does Mr. Baker have?
4 minutes,
Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to address very quickly the standard under Illinois law. The standard under Illinois law from Peppers on down is there a conflict of interest on the part of counsel? That's it. And then there are several contexts in which that has repeatedly come up, and there's come to be sort of a common examples of where a conflict exists, but it's conflict of interest. If that attorney is in a state of conflict of interest as between the insured and the insurer, then the insured is entitled to Pepper's counsel. I would submit to your honors that in an EEOC proceeding where there is, in fact, fact discovery going on, formal or informal, where witness statements are being given, any conflicted lawyer who doesn't have his insured's interest fully at heart could easily manipulate the record in a manner that disadvantages the insured and steers the case out of coverage. I can cite, a simple example would be putting forth an affidavit of the CEO of a company, which includes some acknowledgement that they know what the law was, or that they weren't relying on a bona fide occupational qualification, or that they knew about the underlying discrimination or did not have a valid anti-discrimination policy in place. I could come up with many more examples. There are as many as the imagination can come up with, but the point is if there's a conflict of interest, then the insured is entitled to Pepper's counsel. That can come up at any time when that client is being represented by counsel. And we've got a company that asked to insure EEOC risks and now wants to say, well, but we don't have to follow Pepper's as long as it's just an EEOC charge. We get a free pass on conflict of interest until it reaches litigation. I submit that's not good law and it's not Illinois law. I also wanted to just briefly respond to what counsel said concerning willfulness being embedded in a Title VII charge. Kolstad, I think, makes that fairly clear. If a plaintiff comes forward and says, I suffered disparate treatment discrimination, that plaintiff, without saying it, another word is saying that the defendant acted willfully because everyone is presumed to know what the law is and to know that it's wrong to discriminate. The defendant is afforded the option and the possibility under Kolstad of coming forth with separate affirmative proof to rebut that. And it has nothing to do with necessarily with the defense or the prosecution of the underlying discrimination charge. It's separate. Again, I could come, if I were representing the defendant, I could assert that we had a valid anti-discrimination policy in place and I have a renegade manager who's simply not following our company policy. You could have a defense lawyer who's conflicted who just refused to get that evidence into the record, took a motivation vacation. The insured doesn't have to worry about whether his counsel is conflicted. The insured is entitled to counsel who only has his best interests at heart. And for that reason, we think Pepper's clearly applies in this case. We think that the district court erred, and we would ask this court to please reverse.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for your argument. Next case.